From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in the U.S. State Department in just a few weeks, which is going to get a major shakeup. President-elect Donald Trump has offered conflicting signals about his foreign policy goals. Meanwhile, one of the new appointees in the State Department has said that electing Democrats would mean the end of the American Republic and only Trump can save it. These are interesting times, at the very least. My guest this hour is a Rochester native who served as U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Now he's the Executive Director of the Energy for Growth Hub, which focuses on climate policy and clean energy solutions around the world. And you might have heard him on the show several times before, talking about the international fiction thrillers he writes in his spare time. Todd Moss joins us to discuss the conflicts immediately facing the new Trump administration, the consequences of what could be a more withdrawn U.S. influence, and who should decarbonize and how quickly. Todd Moss, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Hey, Evan. Great to be with you again.
As a Rochester native, are you back here at all anymore these days, or are you primarily down near D.C.?
Oh, my beautiful family still lives there. My parents, my brother, my nephew, my aunts, uncles. I've got a cousin. So I don't get there as often as I should, but still strong hometown connections. Today, I'm actually in southern Arizona, not far from the border. So hopefully we'll talk about that as well today.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to immigration policy. We're going to cover a lot of ground this hour. Listeners, if you want to weigh in, email is connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And I guess I want to start, Todd, with what you think, maybe the broad outlines of what you're looking at the State Department level when it comes to this new administration, and then we're going to get a little bit more specific. But what's on your mind first?
Yeah, I mean, I think the starting point is that this is not a typical transition. So normally there's a whole process. There'll be lots of names floated, and there's what's called a beachhead landing team that would come into the State Department. None of that's happening right now, so it's a little bit unclear. So everything we, you know, anyone predicting exactly what's going to happen, you should take that with a grain of salt. We do know a few names, and in particular, Senator Rubio is the nominee for Secretary of State.
Yep.
He's a fairly traditional pick. He's obviously, you know, he's from Florida. He's close to the president-elect, but he's a longtime member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. So he's very deeply steeped in U.S. foreign policy. And he's got a track record that it's not too dissimilar from a more traditional sort of foreign policy hawk that you would expect from a conservative senator.
Now, when it comes to some of the other people around Rubio, I'm going to read from a piece in just a moment about some of the other appointees. But back in 2016, 2017. I think I asked you, among others who had served in government, about the importance at the time of qualified professionals staying in their posts, of qualified people doing the work, putting their heads down, not getting concerned with what party is in power or even what person is in power, but still serving the country. And you know, there's a pretty good amount of evidence that Donald Trump didn't necessarily expect to win in 2016. A lot of the people around him in that first, not only his cabinet, but the people around him generally were pretty traditional establishment folks with a lot of experience. It's a very different situation. You're certainly right that Rubio looks more like that old guard, but not a lot of the rest. And I wonder now if you're concerned about turnover, about people leaving their posts, or about the value of staying in your post and staying the course with the work, Todd.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the attention in the media is on the political appointees at the top, but there are, you know, very senior professional civil servants in very, you know, important influential positions. Typically, those people are who's called upon to manage, you know, probably 80% of national security decisions. In a campaign is very different from day-to-day foreign policy. You know, we've heard about a few signature foreign policy issues. Certainly Israel and the Gaza crisis will play a big role, the Russia-Ukraine war, and this administration will want to be tough on China and tough on Iran. But there are hundreds of other issues and places that will be like under the political radar, but those will be handled by regional experts and foreign policy professionals. I think that, you know, we will see how Secretary Rubio, assuming he's confirmed, which I would strongly expect, see what kind of people he surrounds himself with and whether he leans on those foreign policy professionals or whether he tries to push them out. I would expect him to lean on them while still trying to make sure he's always keeping the White House happy. So that'll be a balancing act for Secretary Rubio.
What we can glean from Rubio vis-a-vis incoming Vice President J.D. Vance is a very different idea about the role of the United States in the world. Donald Trump talks about, you know, not wanting nuclear war, which I think should be everyone's shared goal, but doesn't really seem to have kind of a really prescriptive or coherent set of ideas, whereas J.D. Vance does, for sure. And Marco Rubio seems to have a pretty consistent set of ideas. I just look at choosing J.D. Vance to be your vice president. When he talks about, why do we care about Ukraine? We don't share a border with Ukraine. We are way too involved in other conflicts. We shouldn't be involved in Syria, shouldn't be involved in Ukraine. Rubio has been very different. How does that square with you? Does that look chaotic and inconsistent? Does that look like there is an intentional selection of people who might have divergent goals? You know, maybe that's the optimist in me saying, you know, team of rivals, you know, bring people together. But how does that look to you so far, Todd?
Yeah, so look, at one level, nothing about this transition is going to be normal or expected. So I think that's the starting point. However, it's very common to have tensions and different views between, say, a Secretary of State and the White House. I remember when President Obama was elected and the Hillary Clinton crew arrived at the State Department, and there were incredible disputes and tensions between those two teams. So it's not unusual for that to happen. I do think Rubio's got a pretty, you know, he's a Cuban American, first generation. He's got a long track record of being a supporter of a muscular U.S. policy for democracy and against autocrats, especially, but not only in Latin America. And he's got a pretty strong pro-Israel track record. So I would expect him to push that while trying to make sure that the White House sees him as a team player. But Evan, I'd say there's also a bigger issue here, which is that all presidential candidates, all of them, campaign saying they're going to focus on problems at home, they're going to do less in foreign policy, and then real life events get in the way. I mean, if you remember Bill Clinton, he campaigned on exactly that, and he wasn't able to do that. And I wouldn't expect Trump 2.0 to be much different. We've already seen Syria force its way into the headlines. Regardless of what we read in the press, there's absolutely no way the U.S. is going to be able to stand on the sidelines in Syria. And that's because slogans like, well, let's get out, or it's not our fight, that sounds good on the campaign trail. But, you know, the U.S. is not going to cede huge swaths of territory to extremist groups. That will not make the U.S. safer. And so, you know, the administration, I think, probably the professionals will know and the political appointees will soon learn that, you know, a disengaged America will be poorer and less safe. And the way to get ahead of that is through proactive engagement. And they will have to come around to that.
I take the point about campaigns differing from governing. But, you know, we're not in a campaign anymore. And J.D. Vance just said exactly that about Syria the other day. It's not our fight. It's not our conflict. That we should not be trying to control each boundary line, you know, each set of rulers in each part of Syria, whether it's unified, partitioned in any way, de facto or not. Vance is saying, you know, we've gotten ourselves in trouble, assuming that we have to be involved everywhere, and we're not going to do that. You don't seem to believe that.
Well, Evan, it's not a black and white. It's not we're going to control everything. We're not the British Empire. We're not going to try to control everything. And we're not going to just walk away and try to wash ourselves of these issues. Do we have to get involved in every skirmish around the globe? Absolutely not. But we do have to use our influence, and we do have considerable influence to shape global events in our favor. I mean, that is exactly the purpose of the United States government, which is to make our country more prosperous, safer, and more secure. And that means using national power, using the military, using diplomacy, using our foreign assistance budget, using our economic might. And, you know, I know we'll talk about energy, but using our energy, our influence in the energy sector to help shape events in ways that are favorable to our own security and to our own prosperity. There's just no way to avoid that, no matter what you're saying in the press.
My guest is Todd Moss, Executive Director of the Energy for Growth Hub. We're going to be talking in our second half hour about the work they're doing and the challenges and opportunities he sees around the world in the sphere of energy. We're also talking about what's going on in the State Department with international conflict and crises now and to come. Todd is the former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs and has a lot of experience in this realm. So I want to read a little bit of what Jonathan Chait published this morning. Chait wrote a piece detailing how the incoming administration is demanding that applicants for higher-level positions in all departments have to first answer three questions. Those questions are the following. Which candidate did they support in the last three elections? What did they think about January 6th? And who did they think was the actual winner of the 2020 election? Anyone who got any of the questions wrong in the new administration's mind was excluded from consideration. And this kind of demand of loyalty and conspiratorial thinking extends beyond, say, the Defense Department. Chait writes the following, quote, "This week, Trump announced that he will appoint Michael Anton as Director of Policy Planning at the State Department. This announcement attracted little attention, and given that Anton already served during the first Trump term in a communications role, it hardly moves the needle. But Anton's appointment does highlight the banal ubiquity of authoritarian thinking in the Trumpified Republican Party. Anton is best known for an essay published 8 years ago called The Flight 93 Election. In it, he argued that conservatives should support Trump despite their serious reservations about his character, because another Democratic term in the White House would amount to the death of the Republic. Only Trump could save it. At the time, Anton's argument stood out for its existential tone and hysterical life and death metaphor. And now his logic, that permitting Democrats to win a single national election is tantamount to national suicide, the prevention of which justifies any measures, legal or otherwise, is a required belief for service in the power ministries, including state. Once an oddball, Anton is just another Trump bureaucrat who subscribes to the party's rule or perish ideology," end quote. Todd, what do you make of all that?
Well, look, I think we should all take a deep breath, okay? There is, you know, a lot of rhetoric on both sides that the country is coming to a disastrous end if either candidate wins. Deep in my bones, don't believe that. There are very worrying things that the president-elect has said and things that he said he will do that I think would be fundamentally damaging to the United States, to our democracy, and to our national security. But I also try to separate some of the noise from what's really happening day to day. I'm sure I'm going to be surprised both on the upside and the downside with what happens. This is an extremely unpredictable administration, and I'm not looking to sugarcoat that. But I don't think we need to take, you know, the scribblings of every appointee too seriously. And we have to put it in context with what is happening on the ground. I also would say that in the Senate, we're going to have Republican majorities of both houses, but there are a lot of adults in the room, particularly Republicans in the Senate, who have long history of dealing with very serious national security issues. And while I expect the White House to really push the hill as hard as they can, that is a, you know, we do have a balance of powers. I'm not going to light my hair on fire. You can call me back when I get this wrong, Evan. I'd be happy to talk to you about it again. But I really don't think that panic is particularly constructive right now.
Fair enough. I do think it. I don't know if I've ever heard about a three question loyalty test for candidates for some of these roles. I don't find that particularly healthy.
I agree. But again, this is an extremely unorthodox candidate and an unorthodox administration. So we shouldn't expect, we shouldn't expect some unusual tactics like we're seeing.
So let me just ask you a little bit about how you're going to be observing the administration's handling of certain crises. And I'm not asking you for a perfect solution or a prescription to handle all of this. It's more of a question on how diplomacy either works or doesn't work and what its role is. You know, so for example, Neil Ferguson and Harry Halem co-authored a piece today about how the next administration should handle Ukraine. And once again, they point to incoming Vice President J.D. Vance, who has talked a lot about how, that's not our fight. That's not a member of NATO, not an ally that we should be overemphasizing. We need less militarism and more diplomacy. So here's what the authors write about that. Quote, "The U.S. negotiating team must learn from history that Russia does not negotiate in good faith, but sees diplomacy as a way to freeze rather than resolve a conflict, to build military leverage, and to split allies. If the U.S. is to end the Ukraine war in a way that satisfies American interests, it must counter Russia's strategy and build military, as well as economic, leverage over Russia. This will require not just surging aid to Ukraine and tightening the sanctions regime, but also imposing costs on Russia and its allies across Eurasia, including in Europe, the Middle East, and the Pacific region," end quote. What do you make of that, Todd? For a moment, I can't hear Todd. I wonder if Todd can hear us.
Whoop, I got you. Oh, sorry.
Was it you? Problem with you?
I think it was on my end about that. Look, I'm not an expert in Russian or Ukrainian politics.
Yep.
But I have seen, I follow Africa extremely closely, and I've seen the nefarious influence of Russian forces across the region. And the United States, Russia is not just threatening Ukraine and Eastern Europe, it's actually a strategic threat to the United States in virtually every part of the world, but it's also a very, very much a weakened adversary. So, I think when you look at the record of the incoming administration, they are, largely about negotiating tactics. And so we will have to see if there is an actual plan in place. I couldn't say whether I believe that or not right now. I don't know, but I'm willing to wait and see. Again, though, I just would caution people not to take every media article too seriously. Take everything with a little bit of a grain of salt and take a deep breath. And let's see how it goes in different cases.
Yeah, whether it's Russia or elsewhere, there's always a question of who has the leverage. It's one of the first things my father taught me when I was in my first contract negotiation. He said, there's always going to be one party with more leverage, and you want to be that party. And if you recognize that you are not, you need to be strategic. So that's a little oversimplified because leverage isn't just a binary, but leverage works in different ways. Can you just describe a little bit, Todd, the work of state and the work of diplomacy in looking for those leverage points and, maybe what a valuable mix is for an administration and for an approach to foreign policy that understands how to use leverage responsibly, appropriately, but not naively?
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of diplomacy is to try to talk through problems and try to resolve them without military force. You use military force as a tool to try to increase your diplomatic leverage. I'd say the big challenge for the new administration going in diplomatically is going to be maintaining the broad coalition of allies that have stood with Ukraine and against Russian aggression. I think, there's some, it's way too soon for history to judge the Biden administration, but if I was to guess, the biggest foreign policy success, it will be the assertive response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and really quite quickly establishing a robust alliance behind them. So we'll see what happens next. But that's really going to be the task of Rubio, both to try to get some kind of negotiations underway with Russia, but also maintaining the strongest possible coalition of allies And I would not expect this to be linear. You're not going to hear one voice coming out of the administration. There's going to be a variety of views, some tethered to reality, more tethered to reality than others. But that's like the art of policymaking, is trying to balance those different influences and those different views and trying to come out with something that gives us a good outcome in the end.
Some of what my guest, Todd Moss, who has worked as Assistant Deputy Secretary of State for African Affairs for the United States, and we're going to be talking about his more current work in just a second here. But, you know, some of what Todd has been saying this hour about not overreacting to a campaign soundbite or an offhand remark in a media scrum, it sort of echoes the invocation to look at what people do and react to what they do less than what they say. And we might be seeing that in action in Syria. I wonder, Todd, you know, so as an example, and this is a very optimistic take, granted, but one of the ways that I wonder if that works in practice is when the capital falls, when Damascus falls, and a rebel group that is not, you know, just a monolith. There have been competing rebel factions in what has been a sort of a de facto partition Syria for years now. Well, now you've got kind of a winner, quote unquote, and the leader, whether it's an individual, Jelani or others, who are thrust into power, have a history of, I mean, they're on a United States terrorist list. They are on British terrorist list. They, you know, they have literally participated in personal violence as part of some of these past terror groups that have connections to Al-Qaeda or ISIS. But now that you actually get the keys to power, they are signaling moderation, respect for religious pluralism, allowing Russians who've been stationed there to leave peacefully, allowing Syrians abroad to come back no matter how they worship or who they are, and signaling some sort of, you know, attempt to normalize relations with the world. And now you've got the Biden administration, presumably the Trump administration, to come. You've got British leaders considering removing this group from a terrorist watch list, probably with the sanguine view that once they get power, they will moderate, because they will want to keep power. They will have to play nice. Is that what that looks like, you know, in practice, the idea that you can talk a good game, but when you get the keys to power, what are you going to do with it? What are you looking at there?
Yeah. So first, I would say, and you know, this goes back to the theme of the novels that we've talked about on past shows, is that you've got a very short window of opportunity, right? So right now is when the administration should be actively engaging to try to steer them in a more positive direction and not push them off and put them into a corner where they're going to feel they have no choices and they have to go in an unhelpful direction. So, you know, the uncertainty in Washington, D.C., this is actually kind of terrible timing. But this is exactly the moment where you try to exert influence and try to support those moderating forces and also make clear the consequences if they go in the opposite direction. I think what the United States wants to avoid is another Taliban. And another, you know, like the fall of Kabul, yeah, and another situation like that. So that's just, you know, it's just underscoring my earlier point that regardless of what sounds good, we cannot disengage from the world. It's not going to make the world safer, more peaceful, or more, you know, more in line with American national interests.
All right, a couple of emails. Rick wants to know. Rick says, Evan, I wonder what your guest thinks about how U.S. voters can be better educated about how foreign affairs impact the safety of our nation. How can we challenge the isolationist tendencies that seem to dominate our nation at the moment? That's from Rick. Todd?
Yeah, look, we've got a long history going back to like the very earliest years of the United States of isolationist tendencies. We're protected by two oceans from most of the world. But we live in a global economy. Both the opportunities for the United States and the threats that we face are entirely global, global in nature. And, you know, the oceans do not provide the protection that we think they once did, if they ever did. I really think the best way to educate yourself would be to travel. You know, if you meet people who are advocates for an engaged America around the world, there are people that have lived overseas. Maybe they've been in Peace Corps, maybe they studied abroad, maybe they visited friends and relatives in another country. That opens your eyes to the world and to see both the possibilities and that not everybody lives exactly like we do in the United States. That was certainly the case for me as a naive college kid. But I do think that, you know, just reading the news about a flood in a faraway place or some disaster, that doesn't really connect you to the world in the way that you would like. You've got to actually meet real people, either get to know people from other parts of the country who are here, or, you know, get your passport and go travel and go see what the world is like. That would be my advice. The other thing I'd say, Evan, is, you know, with the exception of your show, I would encourage people not to immerse themselves in a deluge of media every day. That's not a recipe for happiness. Much of what you're going to read on the internet is wrong, either factually wrong or wrong in judgment. And I certainly, you know, tried to cut down my media intake as I've gotten stressed about the election result or about particular crises. And I think it's been good for my own mental health. And I've certainly coached my team and colleagues to, you know, cool it. Don't doom scroll. That's really the worst thing.
Yeah. Well, Todd is on Substack, as a lot of people are, writing Eat More Electrons. You're less on social media platforms like Twitter. Is that right?
Yeah, I pretty much abandoned Twitter because I just found it not useful anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I unfortunately can largely relate, although I'm trying to quit the habit like it's a really tasty cigarette. And I'm almost there. Dallas has a question. A listener named Dallas has a question just about who it is that works at State. He says, I thought most people who get hired at the State Department are relatives of elected officials, like go to Yale, graduate, get a job at State. No?
No, God, no. No, the way most people working at the State Department are either foreign officers, and you get that job by literally taking an exam. Anyone can take the exam. It's a written exam. You go online. It's very open and transparent. You go right through the front door. If you get through the written exam, you go for an oral exam. It's very competitive, but that's how you get in, and that's a career path into the State Department. And then there's a number of civil servants. And again, you'd get hired through the normal U.S. civil service. You can look at, if they have a website, it's usajobs.gov. You can go have a look. The appointees are really just the very, very top officials. And so the vast, vast majority, I would guess 90 to 95% of the employees at the State Department are not political appointees. They are career professionals that have come through the front door.
His follow-up is, how can we get Americans to appreciate how many billions we send overseas in their name? He seems not to like that.
Yeah, look, sometimes you see these big numbers. You know, we spend a lot of money on a lot of things. Our foreign aid budget is less than the military budget for bands, for, like, you know, music groups in the military. So people get their nose out of joint about the foreign assistance budget. The biggest recipient is Israel. People seem to like that politically. Most of the others are pretty small, and we get a big bang for our buck from using dollars to help increase our influence. This is to help build markets for U.S. investors and U.S. To sell U.S. goods overseas. And, you know, in many ways, we're trying to help stem HIV/AIDS, malaria, TB. There's very strong political support for the U.S. Helping build global, you know, support global health to fight food insecurity. So I would say the vast majority of what we're spending actually goes toward good things. Could it be more efficient? Absolutely. But our foreign assistance budget, and I've seen this in practice, and I've been watching this for over 30 years. You know, most of that is a very, very good investment for the average American citizen. It's making us safer, more prosperous, and helping build allies around the world.
But certainly pragmatically extends our influence in the way that, you know, Belt and Road and China's initiatives are trying to extend their influence, right?
Sure. So Belt Road Initiative is a massive investment program from the Chinese government in infrastructure around the world. The U.S. is doing a little bit of that, but we're not anywhere near the scale of what the Chinese are doing. And I don't think that we should. That's not our model. Our model is to really largely be led by the private sector and by private investors. And there's a role for the government to help kind of nudge open markets and make sure that companies have a level playing field. But, you know, we don't have big, large state-owned banks and companies that are seeking to build an empire around the world. That's just not the American way.
And Bob in Rochester says, isn't part of the budget sent over to, say, Ukraine spent on U.S. industry? So we are, in a sense, paying ourselves partially while helping allies.
Yeah, that's actually a big criticism of the aid budget, is that a lot of it is spent on U.S. supplies and U.S. Personnel. And that's absolutely true. So, you know, I actually think that that's sort of a problem, not with military support, but a lot of the development support. And, you know, when you look, if you're trying to support the end of poverty and better health and education outcomes, it actually works better if you're supporting local groups that are trying to achieve those things rather than paying American experts overseas. It's just, that's more expensive and less effective. But that's sort of an internal Washington debate about how do you get the most bang for your buck from those $8?
Yeah, Bob says it, but doesn't it benefit all involved?
Well, it does. It does. Here's the question: as a taxpayer, would you rather support an American getting something done overseas and supporting that one individual, or supporting 100 local people that could do 100 times as much work for the same dollar? So it's really about whether you care more about just helping local businesses or local citizens with their job, or you're trying to get better outcomes for, you know, more health, living longer lives, and more safety.
Listeners, I've got to pivot. I'm not even going to get to half of what I want to get through with Todd Moss. Here's what we're going to do here. Todd's the executive director of the Energy for Growth Hub, which we're about to talk in great detail about, so listeners understand what they're doing and how he sees energy issues around the world. He has been talking this hour from the vantage point of the former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, which he was. He's a Rochester native who served in the State Department. He writes thrillers. I have to say this. I am not Todd's agent, but I will say this. My father is like the most impossible person to find a Christmas gift for. He's just impossible. Like, he's like, I don't need anything. I don't want anything. He reads 150 books a year. He'll tell you, if there's a book I want to read, I've already read it. Don't try. Well, he found Todd Moss's books a number of years ago and loves them. And that was like one of the rare times I'm like, I have something for you. It's new. You may love it. And now he's read all of them. So now I can't get any of Todd's books unless there's a new one I don't know about. Do you have any new books that you can help me with?
Yeah. So you're not my agent, but you might be my best promoter. So thank you. Thank you, Evan. So I actually do have a new book out that I put out just before the election. You can get it on Amazon. It's called Purple State. And I actually decided to try and write a domestic thriller set in Pennsylvania. And it will touch on a lot of the issues, you know, that I think are relevant in Rochester, including fracking, which I think we're going to talk about after the break.
Okay. So Purple State's the newest of the books. Why haven't we talked just about Purple State? You want to come back and do that sometime? Just talk about that book? I would love that.
Of course. Okay. Always happy to talk to you.
All right. Well, we'll figure that out. Listen, we got to get this only break of the hour, and we'll come right back with Todd Moss, and we are talking energy and a lot more with him after this break. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about medical aid in dying. It used to be known as assisted suicide. Advocates don't like that term. They will call it death with dignity or medical aid in dying MAID laws, M-A-I-D. Canada has medical aid in dying, and it has ignited some debates there about the ramifications of that, who uses it and who doesn't. And in this country, 10 states have it. We're going to talk about MAID, medical aid in dying. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Todd Moss is going to put his Energy for Growth Hub hat on. Now he's the executive director. Tell people what the Energy for Growth Hub is first, Todd.
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit research group. We're spread around the world, and we are dedicated to building a world where everybody takes electricity for granted. Right now, You know, if you wanted to start a business or you're at your house, you would just assume that the electricity would work, that you could afford it. But in about half the world, if you were starting a business, how you would get your electricity and how you'd pay for it and would it work would be like a top priority. And we want to build a world where abundant, reliable, clean energy is available to absolutely everyone. And so everyone can have a good, well-paying job. That's our mission.
Well, you and your colleagues have been sharing this graph on high-income, low-energy countries. Specifically, there aren't any. And it's right. It's valuable to explain this. And I want to talk, first of all, what that means and why. And then in this goal of making energy available to everybody, can you scale up cleaner energy in a way that we haven't quite seen yet? So let's start with the graph. Go ahead.
Yeah. So if I don't know if you can put this in your show notes, but
yeah,
if you look at the relationship between people's income and their use of electricity, they're very, very highly correlated. And this is true over time and virtually everywhere in the world. And if you look at every country and you think about what's the average income of a country and how much electricity does the average person in each country use, it moves together in a nice ladder from the, you know, up the ladder. And part of that graph is totally empty, which means there are no low energy, high income countries, which tells us it's impossible to get richer if you don't have a lot of electricity. You just need a lot. And when you say, well, how much? One thing I often show is that my family refrigerator uses more electricity than most people in Africa, just my family fridge. And if you look across the world, you know, many, many billions of poor people around the world use, you know, 100 kilowatt hours or less per year. And in the United States, the average person uses about 12,000. So we've got just huge orders of magnitude difference in energy use. And it's one of the worst manifestations of global inequality. And it's really holding back a lot of people. I think of a country like Nigeria, which will soon be larger in population than the United States. And they use about 1% of the electricity that we use. And there are tens of millions of young, very highly capable Nigerians that could be building businesses and have jobs if the electricity would just be working. But, so this is a solvable problem, but it's something that's also unavoidable. We just can't build a stable global economy and a stable world without orders of magnitude more electricity for everyone.
Well, so to correct my thinking on this, but one of the things I hear often is that, well, in this country, in the West, in the United States, we are trying to scale up cleaner energies. We often talk about solar and wind. We're trying to scale that up. But the critics or the skeptics say, well, you know, there's just not a grid for it. It's not scalable. You can't get past fossil fuels just yet, and probably not for a long time. Well, meanwhile, the countries that you're talking about that use such smaller amounts of energy generally, they're wondering what would scale, what is viable, and those same sort of skeptics say, well, it's going to have to be fossil fuels before we can even think about other forms of energy. What is your hub's thinking on this?
Yeah, so look, the challenge in the United States and other rich countries is we've got a little bit of electricity growth. You probably read about the new demand from artificial intelligence and the, you know, cloud computing means we're going to need a lot more data centers, and those all run on electrons. So we're going to need more electricity in the United States. But the big challenge is we just have to clean up our power system. We still are burning coal. We've got a lot of gas. We've got to just try to get the cleaner sources, which is everybody talks about wind and solar, but most clean energy is still hydropower. And I think geothermal and nuclear are also very exciting if we have time to get to those. So we need to just clean up our system over time. And that's going to happen, you know, through some nudging from the government, but largely through market mechanisms as new technologies get cheaper and cheaper. The challenge in emerging markets and in places like Nigeria that I'm thinking about is they need to build not just a little bit more, but maybe 10 or in some cases 20 times more electricity than they have now. So they're really starting almost from scratch in some cases. And they need to build as much as cheaply as possible. And so each country is going to have a different mix. No one, it would be insane to bet all of your, you know, put all your eggs in one basket and just bet on one technology. Every country will want to have a mix. You want to try to exploit cheap wind and solar where you can, but you also need sources that are called firm power or, you know, baseload power so that you have it all the time. And a nice balanced mix will differ a lot in different countries. I think we should encourage countries to be as clean as possible, and where we can offer incentives for them to be cleaner, we should do that. But we also shouldn't be fundamentalist about it, and we shouldn't allow concerns about really modest gas use because of climate implications. We cannot allow countries to stay poorer or people's jobs to be lost because of a climate problem that poor people did not create. This was created by the wealthy nations.
Yeah, and so you mentioned nuclear, and so I want to talk about this because, you know, listeners of this program know we talk to people in climate action all the time. There is not a consensus in climate action. There's certainly people in climate action in this country who are very opposed to any new nuclear. And then there are some in climate action who are very passionately in favor of it. And they will tell us, and they've said so, that we have too much of a monolithic thinking of nuclear, that it is not all the same, and it's not, you know, your father, your grandfather's nuclear. So that leads me to Charles's email. He says, Evan, a reminder that you cannot convince me that climate change is real and that I need to care about it if you aren't willing to use nuclear power to decarbonize. So that's from Charles. Todd, what do you think?
Well, I think Charles is absolutely right. I don't think you can say you are serious about climate change and also dismiss nuclear. Nuclear is probably, you know, it has some special challenges, as we all know, but it's probably the most useful energy source because of its scale, its reliability, and a really tiny footprint. You know, the biggest problem with wind and solar is not really the intermittency that it goes on and off depending on local weather, but that people don't want solar panels where their forests are, and they don't want to see wind turbines in their views. I happen to think wind turbines are beautiful. I'd love them in my view, but most people don't want that. Nuclear has a tiny footprint. And so I think if you are serious about climate, you have to be serious about nuclear. The big question is whether these new models, which I think are quite exciting, whether they're going to be able to be cheap enough to compete with natural gas. That is really the question. We don't know that yet, but I would say the early signs are pretty promising. If you read the news, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Meta have all made deals with nuclear companies. They see that as the low carbon future for them, because obviously a data center needs super reliable power. So I'm pretty bullish on nuclear. I'd also add, you know, there's been some really exciting developments in fusion, which is instead of splitting atoms, you merge them together. And that has no radiation effects as well. Some of the very exciting advances in the science there, it's possible in a couple of years that we'll see those closer to commercialization as well, which all just underscores some of these will work, some will not. It just underscores we've got to keep investing in new technologies and imagine what's possible.
Let me get through as much as I can in the next 8 minutes here with Todd Moss. A listener wants to know, in regards to small modular reactors, is it smart or safe to give this nuclear technology to African nations that are less than stable?
Yeah, so obviously there are safety and waste concerns with all reactors. The small modular reactors are built to be self-contained with low regulatory requirements. But, you know, there is an international regime in place managed by an agency in Austria that sort of certifies countries that they're ready for this. It's pretty rigorous. I'd argue it might even be too rigorous. So that is not a concern that I have, especially with the types of fuels that most of these smaller reactors are planning to use.
Okay. Now, you mentioned gas, even fracked gas. Obviously, New York State is different than Pennsylvania, our neighbor. Fracking was a big issue in the election. Pennsylvania fracks, New York State does not. What does the hub think about fracked gas, whether it's here, but also, you know, gas as an option around the world?
Yes. Yeah, so let me say anything I'm saying today is not, I'm not speaking on behalf of the organization. I'm just giving you my personal view. Yeah.
Okay.
So look, fracking, look, it has benefits. It has some pretty severe costs. And I think it's really important that local communities have input into those choices. And we would not want, you know, you would not want an external or certainly a foreign agency to make those choices for you. So I don't particularly have strong views on fracking in New York or Pennsylvania. But one of the most exciting things to come out of fracking is that the technology used for fracking gas and oil is actually now being applied to geothermal, which is effectively drilling for steam in the earth. And so geothermal right now is only cost effective in places where the reservoir is very close to the surface. So we've got a few places out west. Kenya in East Africa has a lot of geothermal activity because of volcano activity. But the fracking technology is now being applied there, where I think within our lifetimes, we will be able to have geothermal power everywhere. And so this is one of those things where one technology built for one industry can be applied in another way. And I think it is super exciting. And I would definitely, if you're an energy nerd like me, you should definitely be watching what they call enhanced geothermal, especially out in the U.S. West.
We'll definitely want to be following that story. Geothermal is fascinating. Okay, before we lose the hour here, I did want to ask you a little bit. You write in your bio that you think a lot about things like immigration. It's an important issue for the country right now. And I want to give you some time to just talk a little bit about how you see the current debate about it and what you would like to see in terms of policy.
Yeah, well, I'm actually, you know, I'd say if there's anything I'm distraught about the new administration, it's their policy on immigration. I understand the political concerns and this sort of incentive when you're scared to close doors or kick out the ladder, and it can be easy to blame outsiders when you feel anxious. But really, if you think about both the ideals of the United States and what's in our economic interests, we are going to be heavily reliant on immigrants culturally and absolutely economically. You know, unless you're a Native American, your recent ancestors came here, were a nation of immigrants. It's actually our superpower. It's one of the reasons that the United States has such a vibrant economy. The reason we have so many startup companies. And one of the reasons that we are growing faster than most of our European allies, it's because of our relative openness to immigration. You know, Evan, in the 70s, people worried about the population bomb.
Yeah.
But the bigger problem is actually population collapse. We are now below replacement level for our native-born population. And the only way that we're going to grow our population is through immigration. And now, while some people might think that's bad, our economy depends on it. And if you like Social Security, you're going to need immigrants to help pay into that pool.
Well,
I think it's pretty important.
I certainly understand the point that you've been making all hour of, you know, don't overreact to a soundbite. Let's see what happens in practice. So in a sense, that applies to the idea of, as Donald Trump says, deporting 12 to 20 million people. That seems very unlikely. But he reiterated this week in an interview that he wants to do it. What kind of effect could that have on the economy in the country, you think?
Well, I don't think it's possible, but you know, yeah. I think they're absolutely going to make a show of it. I think of it a little bit like the Southern Wall. The wall made a big deal. People talked about it. It's completely ineffective and pretty much irrelevant. I would expect that we will see some theatrics with rounding up undocumented workers. Mm-hmm. But the underlying economic fundamentals, our entire housing sector depends, agriculture and housing depends on increasing the number of immigrants rather than pushing people out. So unless you want higher food prices and you want the housing crisis to get worse, we're going to have to figure out a way to expand the labor pool in the United States. And that can only come from outside.
But that music's going to play here. So just do this in 15 seconds. People will say, but what about illegal immigration? I mean, it's not all the same.
Yeah, that's true. But the path to legal immigration is fundamentally broken.
Okay. That's a conversation, again, to pick up on a different day. and maybe Todd, you will be generous enough to come talk about Purple State, your newest book. You'll come back to this program, and we can get back, maybe we will save a little time at the end to kind of get into some of these issues and delve in a little bit more.
Anytime, Evan. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Todd Moss, the Executive Director of Energy for Growth Hub. He's speaking on his own behalf only today because we covered a lot of ground, including talking about the State Department, where he used to work, talking about a number of issues, and we always appreciate that. We got more connections coming up in a moment.